Support for Southbound comes from WFAE members and Southeast Radiation Oncology Group, offering non-invasive alternatives to surgery and treatments in radiation oncology. Details at treatcancer.com.
Me coming in as a female represented what they call the double insult or a double threat, and as they told me, all I could do is get good white men killed.
That's the voice of Janie Mines. In 1976, Mines became the first black woman to attend the U.S. Naval Academy. The Navy fought to keep her and other women out. And once she arrived as part of the initial group of 81 women, many of her fellow midshipmen were furious that she was there. What was her life like for those four historic years in Annapolis? And as she changed the Naval Academy, how did it change her? Hey, y'all, I'm Tommy Tomlinson. And from WFAE in Charlotte, this is Southbound. Janie Mines has gone on to a long career in business management and consulting. But until recently, she'd never gone back and collected her thoughts about her time as the first black woman at the Naval Academy. Now she's collected those thoughts in a book called No Coincidences, which is about not just those key 4 years, but the life that prepared her for them. Here's our conversation. So, Janie Mines, I've read your book and really enjoyed it. And I guess the description I keep coming back to, especially as you talk about your childhood, or the one is small but fierce. You're always standing up to a bully, or you're beating somebody down, or you're like, you know, trying to whip your instructors in karate class and all this sort of thing. And I guess I wonder, where did that sort of fury, that part of you, where do you think that came from?
Oh, excellent question. You know, it's just always been there, and it's probably about 5% of my personality. It only comes out when it needs to come out. And I kind of attribute it to sometimes God needs warriors, but most of the time he wants us to be, you know, good, calm people. But every once in a while, he needs us to step up and do what he has us to do, and that's not always, you can't always do that the easy way. And so I really attribute that to him, because it wasn't like I had any reason to be angry about anything. And I wasn't. It was just whenever confronted with something that I felt was unfair, then I unleashed a fury. And it was, you know, it was interesting. After leaving the academy, that was something I had to learn to dial back.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I felt like another aspect of that was once it got switched on, you found it hard to switch off. Like, you had to be pulled off of people, basically.
Yes, I had to learn to do that. That was part. I had a sensei in my karate school, which was one of the things that my parents and older cousins recommended for me in terms of learning to manage that, who was very good at teaching me not only how to do that, but why it was important to be able to control that.
There's a scene early on that you keep coming back to that I want to talk about in some detail now and maybe a little later. And it's the moment where you're trying to get some consolation from your mom mm-hmm. about something, and then your sister comes in. Mm-hmm. And I maybe can set that up a little bit. Your sister at the time had been sort of sickly, I guess. Is that right?
Yes.
And explain sort of what happened there and why that scene still sticks so much in your memory.
You know, it's funny. We have that old Southern term called sickly. And she... because of situations that were going on in my mother's life when she was carrying her, she ended up being born and actually not having a good prognosis in terms of being able to grow up. Fortunately, that didn't occur. But what happened because of that, and because my mother's mother was ill at the time, there wasn't much time for me. So my mother felt really, I think, guilty because she was so busy working with her mother and doing what she needed to do. She felt that she had not done what she needed to do for herself to have a healthy child. So she put all her energy into my sister. What I wanted, though, was a little of her attention. So she was sitting in the living room. She was all alone, and that never happened. My sister was always with her. And I came in and climbed in her lap and just nuzzled in and just real quiet because I didn't want anything disturbing. And my sister came in crying. And my mother wanted me to get down so she could get up. And I tried to ignore her. I just wanted to enjoy that. And my mother told me to get down. And that literally broke my heart. And I think I cried. I didn't cry in front of her. I just got down and walked away, but I never got in her lap again. What it taught me, you know, sometimes we learn from things that we really enjoy, but we also learn from things that were difficult for us. And what that taught me was never to be so vulnerable to needing anybody that much. And it was great going to the academy because I didn't have anybody but my three invisible friends, and that's a whole nother story. Don't lock me up, folks. but it taught me to be more dependent on them, and actually was a blessing in my life.
You talked about your three invisible friends,
yes.
The God, Jesus, and the Holy Ghost. Yes. I laughed when in your book you talked about you would play games in your yard and you would always be on God's team. I felt like the Old Testament God was sort of a little rougher than the other two characters there. And you, it sounds like you grew up with some friends, but basically kind of in your own head as a child. Is that accurate?
I guess that's a way of describing it. I had a lot of acquaintances. I was very, I am and was very social, but I didn't let people, but so far into my life, part of that was just because it was just so busy. I didn't have a lot of social time. I always feel like I'm on a treadmill trying to learn, develop, be ready for the next thing. And it started that way as a small child.
And along the way, as you went through school, obviously you were high achiever in school, did a lot of things, had a lot of extracurriculars and stuff, got to be a senior, and colleges started calling, and you started applying, and you had a, if I remember this right, you had a scholarship offered to Cal Berkeley, mm-hmm. a ROTC scholarship, and then had been accepted to some Ivy League schools. Mm-hmm. But then this you met a recruiter for the Naval Academy. Now, at the time, did you even know that the Naval Academy was starting to recruit women, or that was going to be the first year that women were going to be part of the academy?
Now, this is going to sound really ignorant, but I didn't even know there was a Naval Academy.
Well,
because it was just a boys' school.
Yeah, right. So and it just wasn't even on your radar.
Not at all. And that's an interesting part, I think, of the testimony, is that in our preparation in life, we need to prepare a lot these days for what we don't know about, because things are changing so quickly that we have to be prepared for opportunities that don't even exist today. And so we need to look at our preparation more broadly and not locking ourselves into a certain path because we have, quote unquote, our own plan.
Right.
So it's, yes, that's right. And his name is Commander Scott. They call him Blue and Gold Officers. And he came, I was in JROTC in high school because my parents told us that we were going to college and we were going to pay for it. It was years before I found out later that other people's parents paid for them to go to college. But
it was on
that's
you.
Right, that's yeah. right. It was on us. And so I joined everything that offered scholarship. And Cal Berkeley was an ROTC scholarship. And he came and approached me and told me he'd work with me, get all the paperwork done, because I was already accepted to every school I applied to, thank God. And he did that, and I found more about the institution. And remember the part I just told you about being on a treadmill, having to learn as much as I could? The academy offered me so many things simultaneously. I had family members who were veterans, and at that time, some on active duty. So I got to serve. I got an Ivy League education. I got to totally release my parents from any responsibility because you get paid to go to school at the Naval Academy in addition to your scholarship. And you learn so much more than the typical college student. When I was 23 years old, I had 500-600 people reporting to me. How many 23-year-olds say that?
Right. Mm-hmm. Was it your research that convinced you to go, or was it something he said to you that convinced you to go? Or
when you say he, the he I'm thinking about is God.
Okay.
So it's everything that I had done up until that point was in preparation for that moment. I'd always been the only female or the only black, and quite often both. All the things that were necessary for me to survive in that environment had been provided to me in terms of learning and experience. And when they called me, what pushed the button, and I realized that it was God and was something I needed to do, was when they called me and said, "You're going to be the only one. You still coming?" That was the conversation.
still coming, like
that was the Naval Academy.
We hope you're not coming. Or
it almost sounded like a threat. Like I dare you to come. But and I said, okay, God, another one of those. In other words, another, you need to open this door. You need to maybe help people to understand things differently. So that really confirmed, because sometimes you search for God's will. And is this really something you want me to do? And then you have like the verifying moment. That was a verifying moment for me when I realized that was going to be that way.
I want to back up just a little bit. At what point in the process did you realize that this was the first class of women to be admitted?
Probably at the very beginning. I think the commander communicated that.
And I assume, and I think maybe you referenced it in the book a little bit, as it got closer to actually happening, this sort of dawned on the rest of the country. Mm-hmm. This was the thing. So were people calling you and asking mm-hmm. you about this moment, and did it make you that attention? Did that unnerve you at all about getting ready to be there?
Again, you know, it's my book is called No Coincidences,
right?
Because God prepared there. I firmly believe there are no coincidences, that He has a plan for us. So I had been so many things as a child, and I had media attention before. So it, I guess maybe it should have, but it didn't unnerve me. It didn't bother me at all. I knew I needed to be careful, because what I said then would follow me to the academy. Mm. But no, I it wasn't new to me.
And did you have conversations with your parents about that? Like, did they say, here's some things you might expect, or, you know, this might be what it's like for you, that sort of thing?
Well, I kind of mentioned that in the book. It's funny. In all those different experiences where I was the first or only, my parents said nothing. So, and I said it might have been nice if every once in a while they tap me on the shoulder and say, you might want to reconsider this.
Right.
But no, they just, I think they kind of left it to God, too, because maybe early on probably the only thing was the karate, because they didn't like for me to come home beat up because I was such a stubborn child. but they saw that it worked out, that God took care of it. And so they didn't want to, this is me thinking for them, probably didn't want to discourage me or place fear where fear didn't currently exist.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I'm going to get to your experiences at the academy mm-hmm. in a minute, which many of which are very rough. Mm-hmm. But I want you to just go back a little bit and describe that first day, like when you first got there and you saw the campus, maybe for the first time, I guess. Mm-hmm. And what was that moment like when you got there and you saw it? And what feelings did you have right then?
When you cross the Severn River, there's a bridge that crosses the Severn River near the Academy campus, and you see the grounds, and they are absolutely beautiful. Combination of what looks like an old castle, a huge castle, and these new academic buildings, a beautiful chapel. They call it the Cathedral of the Navy. So first, you're awestruck by that because it is just wonderful. Then coming in, that first day, they had us coming in on a rolling schedule, so we wouldn't all come in at the same time. I saw the media out there. I kind of dodged them and got into the building because I, again, didn't want to. That's not what this day was about. I needed to get in there and figure out what it was they had for me to do. Got split into our different companies, got our uniforms, just got all the basic stuff that we were going to need as plebes for plebe summer. And went to our company areas, went back, got sworn in by the superintendent, kissed your parents. That's the first time my mother showed a little concern. She was kind of crying. And then I went back to the company area, and I, to put it, Molly was not welcome there. And I think one of the things that flashed in my mind as it was happening was the reverse of my parents going back across that bridge, and they were gone. And you're here, and you got to deal with it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I have one quick question that's mm-hmm. probably kind of a dumb question. Y'all were the first group of women that had been there. Did they have clothes that, like, fit y'all well? I mean, did they?
No.
So what were the, I mean, how did that work?
They had strings in them. You could tie a rock and keep them up.
Oh, really?
they just tack things together as quickly as they could until they had time to come up with uniforms that better fit us.
Right.
But the shoes were one of the huge problems, where they put 2-inch heels on our shoes that we ran around in every day. A lot of women, and including myself, have back problems from that to this day.
So all the stuff that the men were doing mm-hmm. in their shoes, you were doing in heels. Yeah, that was not the smartest move no. by the academy there. But much of what you talk about in your book is the, you know, I don't know how else to say it, the abuse that you received from upperclassmen, some professors, other people there. Now, I understand that it's sort of the job of the upperclassmen to be hard on the plebs, the mm-hmm. first-year students. And I assume part of the reason of that is to drive out the ones who aren't fit mm-hmm. to be officers or whatever. But your experience, you felt like, went above and beyond the normal, right?
I talk about it in the preface of the book to try to kind of contextually set it up, because that was part of the Naval Academy, and you needed to get people out in the fleet that could perform the mission, which was a difficult job for anyone. So it was to understand, midshipman, mental, moral, physical. Those three character traits were very important. So you had to be able to be extremely intelligent, extremely honorable, fast on your feet, deal with stress, Miss America on steroids type, and just be able to do it all at the same time. And their job was to make sure that anybody who didn't meet that should be put out. For me, what they added to that, because at the same time, this was a period where Black men had only recently stopped being stewards. The Navy, it probably is the slowest in terms of acclimating to change. So there was a lot of concern that Black men could not lead a white male Navy. So me coming in as a female represented what they call the double insult or a double threat. And as they told me, all I could do is get good white men killed. So that's something I explain in the book. It goes far beyond race and gender. A lot of them, and for a few of them, that was their major point. But I never believed that was it for most of them. They firmly believed, just like a lot of the kids on the playground or a lot of children I dealt with growing up, that Blacks were inferior, couldn't do the job. And whether they were inferior or not, the white males that were in the Navy weren't going to accept them as leaders. And it would just cause chaos and impact good order and discipline to have me as a Black female out there in a combat role, which we would eventually evolve into.
There are a couple of instances that you describe where there are these upperclassmen who are kind of in your face, threatening mm-hmm. you, and you push back, which I assume is not protocol no. for those sorts of interactions, and I guess could have gotten you in trouble, right? Talk about sort of the calculation you made in those moments, how to react in some of those situations.
There was a guidebook at the Naval Academy called the Midshipman Hell Publication. So the ones who were in my face to the level that they were in my face were also outside of the rules.
So, is that because there were only certain times they could do something?
Well, it could have been certain times. It could have been the fact that they weren't allowed to be physical. They're not supposed to hit us. They're just certain behaviors. They should not have been physically threatening. You know, you can say things, but you don't actually put your hands on people.
And that happened to you?
Yeah. Mm-hmm, yeah. Yes. So it's when they broke the rules, and quite often it was one-on-one, then they opened the door for me to respond in kind. So, yes, I usually responded to whatever they did or said the same way that they gave it to me.
And obviously, from our conversation so far, you're a good Christian woman, but there's some very unchristian language in this book that you used in the moment. Was that part of that, childhood? I mean, did it come from the same place? Is that sort of when you would flip the switch on and get really angry?
No, this was more calculated, just like theirs was. At the academy, we scream and yell and say unpleasant things at each other for effect and to see if it will affect you. A lot of mine was just giving them back what they gave to me and letting them see that not only did it not affect it, I'm not accepting it from you because it is not what you would expect of a fine gentleman naval officer. That's not that behavior is unacceptable. And I wasn't going to tolerate it. There was very little anger in me. If it was, it lasted 2 seconds when I was dealing with those situations. Like my sensei, like I taught, I had been taught not to do that.
When we come back, Jenny Mines talks about her friends in the Naval Academy's unofficial 7th Battalion, and the time she got encouragement from an unexpected source. That and more ahead on Southbound.
Support for Southbound comes from WFAE members and Southeast Radiation Oncology Group, offering non-invasive alternatives to surgery and treatments in radiation oncology. Details at treatcancer.com.
If you'll indulge me for just a second, I want to let you know that I have a new book out. It's called The Elephant in the Room, and it's about my struggle as an overweight man in a country that's getting bigger all the time. We all struggle with something, and I hope you'll find something that strikes a chord with you as I tell the story of not just how I worked on losing weight, but how I gained an understanding of why I got so big in the first place and how to start turning things around. The Elephant in the Room. It's available in hardback, ebook, and audiobook, and you can get it at your local bookstore, Amazon, or anywhere you buy books. Each week on Southbound, we take a moment to highlight our listeners. This week, I want to thank a Twitter user who goes by the handle MDWords. Here's what he said about our last episode with Chuck Reese of the Bitter Southerner website. Quote, "Another great peek into the colorful characters who channel our Southern soul to the world. Thank you, Tommy Tomlinson, Chuck Reese, and WFAE," unquote. Thank you, MD Words. And if you enjoy the podcast, we want to hear from you too. The best way is to leave us a rating and review on Apple Podcasts, which helps spread the word about Southbound to a larger audience. You can always email me at ttomlinson@wfae.org or tweet at me at Tommy Tomlinson. Subscribe to us on our favorite podcast provider, and you'll hear new episodes first. Now, back to our conversation with Janie Mines. When something like that happened, though, and you ended up, you know, at the end of the day, lights out, and you're in bed, did that sort of ball up inside you at all? Were you able to sleep well? I mean, how did that affect sort of your, how did that constant knowledge that something like that might happen just affect sort of your day-to-day health and well-being?
You mean other than sleeping with a knife? No, not a problem.
Really now?
Yeah, we had bayonets on our rifles, so I used to sleep with the bayonet because there were 81 women, 4,400 men spread out across the largest dormitory in the world, and we weren't allowed to lock our doors. So they could come in anytime they wanted to and bother you. So I slept, you didn't sleep soundly, and I slept with a knife to dissuade anyone who came in through the door.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And you also described you felt like some of the professors there had similar feelings to some of the upperclassmen that you didn't belong there. And I was going to say, how did they express those feelings?
Well, but I mentioned in the book, I think I considered changing my name tag to Midshipman Janie L. Nigger, Class of 80. Because the professors would call me nigger. They lowered my grade. They said that they had 10% officer potential for so many of my grades for the first 3 years were lowered a grade point. Some of them just tried to give me zeros. And if they just went crazy like that, I would just go and fight it. I would have to fight for my grades sometimes. So they just, they would make fun of me in class. It was just, you know, you left that was what was going on. Bancroft Hall is what we call the hall. That's where that large dormitory I talked about. And so it would go on there, and then you go to class and would go on there too. And I think what made the academy experience a little different was that at most universities, if you're having situations where you're not being accepted or whatever, you get to leave. But this was 24/7, 7 days a week, and there was no leaving.
And in general, I know you said you fought your grades a couple of times. Mm-hmm. In general, you didn't feel like you had much recourse, right? Because complaining was, I guess, considered a sign of weakness.
Well, and nobody cared. So as when it was getting, like you said, I try my best to be a good Christian woman, and I did not enjoy fighting those men. And so it because I had an unfair advantage, I knew how to fight, and I fought in the ring. And I didn't like hitting them. Even if they hit me first, I just was uncomfortable with hitting them. So I tried to go to senior leadership and say, this is what's going on. You know, I'm being physically attacked, racial slurs, grades being lowered, all this stuff. And leadership looked back at me and said, what did you expect when you came here? And as far as I was concerned, I said, okay, then I'll do what it takes to stay here. Mm. So they opened, they gave me no recourse. And in a warrior environment, you have to show that you can be a warrior. Now, that's true of everybody there. Did they take it a step further with me? Yes. Did they need to? Maybe. Because the enemy in a war zone is not going to be nice to me. You know, a lot of the same stereotypes and prejudices that are part of our world have been transferred to other worlds. And they believe those things about me, too. They're not going to be nice to women anyway in uniform. So I'm not going to, I'm probably going to be treated worse if I'm captured. So, you know, I used to kind of justify it that way, and it did make some sense. But you also want your brothers to treat you like you're part of the team.
Speaking of that, feeling like you're part of the team, so you were there from 76 to 80. Mm-hmm. In 1979, a Naval Academy graduate named Jim Webb, who went on to become a Democratic senator from Virginia, wrote this big story that got published and talked about nationwide called Women Can't Fight. Mm-hmm. And he basically went into great detail, basically saying why women weren't fit for the academies, weren't fit for combat, everything from them being, you know, in his words, horny, mm-hmm. and to just physical inabilities and that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. That must have dropped like a bomb on those of you who were there trying to get ahead.
Mm-hmm. I mean, things had kind of finally started to calm down. We were seniors. The first class of women were seniors. And, you know, it was a constant battle for all of us. And it started to calm down, and that reignited everything. You know, it made us plebs again. We were under attack again. To a certain extent, and you can probably pick some of that up in the book, I kind of feel sorry for him, too.
Because I wonder, did he ever apologize for that?
Yes, he tried to. But that never got, see, unfortunately, that never got the media attention that his first article did. Because to this day, guys are walking up to girls and shoving that in their face 40 years later. So, yes, he did. And a lot of people don't know that he tried to apologize. He did. He was probably under his watch. The most billets were open to women. He was Secretary of the Navy. Than anybody else. But what he hasn't done, if I ever get a chance to talk to him, what he need, we have Forrestal lectures.
And
Forrestal lectures are where dignitaries come back and they speak to the entire brigade of midshipmen, all 4,400 of us in this big auditorium. And they talk about particular topics that are germane to our futures or the type of people we need to be. And I would encourage him, if he feels led, to come back and do a Forrestal lecture about that situation and where he is today versus where he is now, you know, today versus where he was back then.
Right.
So, yeah, but I had a young lady who's still a midshipman at the academy come up to me who was just vehement in her dislike for him. And I said, that's interesting. I said, what if I looked at your social media pages 40 years from now and judged you on them? Where would you stand?
That's going to kill everybody 40 years from now.
Yes, it is.
Yeah.
Yes, it is. I said, because at the time, he was not much older than my son. And being influenced by a lot of senior leaders who were very quiet now as he has been held accountable for the things that he said.
So this group of, if I remember right, 81 women mm-hmm. who were there, did you feel like you had allies in that group? Did, even if not friends, did you feel like you had people you could count on, or did y'all talk about your experiences together?
Well, in fact, the Academy administration said if they saw more than five of us together, they'd write us all up for mutiny, which is a Class A offense, and we'd be restricted. So they did not allow us to form support groups. The superintendent at the time was very vocal in his belief that women didn't belong there. It was not a fostering environment that would allow those types of conversations. Also, all the women in different ways, depending on your company areas, but it was a challenge for most of us. And most women were just in their own self-survival modes. And for me, I think most of them looked at me, I call myself the Christmas temp. Most people looked at me and assumed there was no way in the world that I was going to survive. And also, I drew a lot of negative attention. I was not somebody you wanted to be with.
You do have these moments that you talk about where there's a little, you know, flower rising out among the weeds. You talked about there was a group there, kind of an unofficial group called the 7th Battalion. Mm-hmm. Explain what that is.
The Naval Academy student body is made up of 6 regular battalions. The black midshipmen call themselves the 7th Battalion. And it was kind of a support group, social group. They were, for the most part, opening. At least they didn't run me off. Some different midshipmen, just like different white midshipmen, felt, you know, they had their own opinion about whether women should be there or not. But for the most part, those guys just ignored me, and the others would let me participate in whatever the 7th Bat was doing, which was really good.
And that was sort of socializing and that sort of thing, mm-hmm. a lot of that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. You got in a little trouble one time for a party, if I remember right, mm-hmm. But not much. This seems mm-hmm. like that's one where somebody actually kind of stood up for you mm-hmm. in that moment.
There were. I talk about angels in the book. And so, you know, it's sometimes people, when you're in an environment that is so negative and so openly negative, it takes a lot of strength to stand up and say something. So I feel like there were quiet angels in the background, but he was an overt angel. We went to this party, and one of the plebes got drunk and came back. And it was an unsanctioned party. So he came back, he got in trouble, and he spilled the beans on everybody who was there. And the senior leader had us come to see him one at a time, lined up outside of his office to talk to us about it. Typically, when you have an infraction, the company officer addresses it. But maybe because it was such a large and singular demographic, he really wanted to understand what was going on. So I went into my chance came up and I went in to see him. And I thought he would. Based on my experience so far, if he was fair, my punishment would have been minimal. But I hadn't seen fair yet, so I was not sure what he was going to do. So I went in to see him, and midshipmen have to keep their eyes on the boat, plebes, which means you stare straight ahead. You never make contact with a senior. And so I was staring straight ahead, and he asked me, did I go to the party? And, sir, yes, sir. And he asked me why. And so we have 5 basic responses. Yes, sir. No, sir. Aye, sir. I'll find out, sir. No excuse, sir. So I said, no excuse, sir. He said, no, I really want to understand. And it was like when he said that, it was like somebody dropping, you know, an anvil on my foot. I'm like, what is he trying to set me up for? Why is he asking me? Who cares what I really think or feel about? Nobody cares about that. I would think he was just going to, if I told him, he was just going to say something really mean. And finally he looked at me and said, look at me. He yelled at me. Look at me and answer my question. And I looked at him and he said, well, why did you go to this party? And I said, well, there'd be black girls there. He said, what? And I said, you know, somebody would talk to me and they'd tell me where I could get my hair done. And you know, I get a chance to fit in if just for a minute. He's kind of looked at me, and he looked so sad. He looked at me, and I almost felt like he had tears in his eyes, too. And he said, get out of my office, and don't you ever come back. And I stopped because I was waiting for my punishment. And he looked up, and I was still, and he said, I said, get out. And I actually went off and cried because it was like he proved that they weren't all monsters, you know, that he was a good guy.
And you had this other experience that I wanted to ask you about. You injured your knee, mm-hmm. had some surgery that didn't go so great. Mm-hmm. As you got to the end of your time to graduate, mm-hmm. you had to complete a mile run. Mm-hmm. And it's in 7:30, if I remember mm-hmm. that. Mm-hmm. And they kind of waited till the end because you were mm-hmm. hurt. Mm-hmm. And sort of describe what that moment was and what you thought was happening and kind of what mm-hmm. happened.
To put that in context, when I initially had an injury, and was told, and I was, everybody else was told to leave, and I was left there with the senior midshipman. They basically exacerbated the injury and were very unkind. So when this happened again 4 years later, I wasn't sure what to make of it. In other words, everybody else had left. I was going to be the last person to run, and that's because I probably looked like an aardvark trying to run because my knee was kind of rigid. So when they told me to do it, I was cautious. At least I'm a senior now. So I was cautious. I wasn't sure what they were going to do. But so I was happy when they just told me to come up to the line, get ready, and go. And so I started running, and then I heard what was like music to my ears. They were cheering for me, and that had never happened before. And they were, you can do it. You know, I think they were surprised that I was going that fast because I did. I described myself as some huge prehistoric bird just lumbering around the tracks. But they kept yelling and they kept calling out my time. And as I got to the last lap, they were saying, you can do it. You got to. And when I got to the last part of the last lap, they just screamed, run. And I just ran as fast as I could, got it across, and they said 7:27. And so I just fell out on the track. I was crying. I was in pain. I was exhausted. And they were like, What's wrong? I said, no, I'm fine. I'm good. And so they asked me if I was all right, and I said I was, and then they left.
So you made it, obviously, and you graduated. You were the first Black woman to attend, first Black woman to graduate, and that was in 1980. Mm-hmm. What was graduation day like?
You know, it was mixed feelings. I was actually afraid of what would happen when I walked across the stage. I didn't want anybody to say anything ugly. So I was just happy to get across the stage and nobody yelled anything.
Was there any sort of...
No.
Anything other than just the normal...
Just quiet. So I grabbed it and ran as fast as I could. I just wanted to get off that stage.
And then how did it feel for that, all you went through, to be over?
You know what? One blessing that God gave me throughout this entire journey was I never internalized it. I tried to understand motivations, objectives. I focused on the next thing. I never looked at it in its totality. I probably looked at it more in its totality in the writing of this book than I ever did at any other time. So again, even in graduation, it was like, what's next? It was not looking back. I love my Naval Academy brothers. If you look at my endorsements in the book, a lot of them are white males. And if, you know, to this day, if anybody stepped to them, they're going to have to come past me. So it's sometimes we need to look beyond the obvious. Especially for me, a lot of times people who look nothing like me are people whose company I enjoy the most because I took the time to understand who they were and where they're coming from and not take everything they say as though it's some personal attack on me. We have to see past that, and we have to let one another talk, and we have to get to know each other for who we are and not stop letting other people shape our opinions of who we are. So I wasn't particularly relieved. I was no more than anybody else, glad to graduate and glad that part's over and glad nobody threw anything at me when I went across the stage. But, you know, other than that, it was just a normal day. Now I got to get ready to go to the fleet and do my job out there.
You talked about having all these people who kind of endorsed you in the book and everything. Mm-hmm. But it's also, you talked about not making many friends while you were there. Mm-hmm. Are some of those people you've become friends with afterward, or the relationships you've made at reunions or something? How did you have now this group of people who, you know, appreciate you and fondly remember your time there when at the time there didn't seem to be many?
The service academies are unusual places, and I can't speak for the other main two. But the Naval Academy, the graduates are very close. So once you graduate, that's a huge hurdle. In jobs in the fleet, in jobs working for the Secretary of the Navy, other jobs in the Pentagon, you see each other. When I got out of the Navy, I'll never forget the person who puts us in our next job, said, you think you're getting away, but you'll never leave. And I laughed at him, saying, you don't tell me where I'm going. And he was absolutely right.
Meaning what?
That the Navy has been an active part of my life ever since I went to the Naval Academy. I continue to work with and mentor midshipmen and young officers. I continue to go back to the Naval Academy whenever they ask me to come back and do anything. I continue to go to the Pentagon and work whenever they ask me to come there and work. I'm on Dakowitz for the Secretary of Defense right now, the Defense Advisory Council on Women in the Services. And doing that, I'm constantly coming back across these people. And they have been nothing but supportive. If I needed anything, and Naval Academy graduates do that for each other. As long as you remain intelligent and honorable and all the things that we talked about you had to be to graduate, you, your brothers and sisters are going to take care of you.
Have you had people afterward, you know, in the years since, apologize to you?
Yes. Yes, many.
What would something like that be like? I mean, what would somebody say?
They call me because they call me into their offices or whatever and say, I'm sorry. And that would be, and I say, okay. It was not anything really, because most of the time, like I said, I didn't internalize it. I wasn't angry with them.
I find that hard to understand.
I don't know why people find that hard to understand. What I felt like I was doing was something that God had for me to do. He took care of all that. I would be a messed up person if I internalized all that stuff. And he allowed me to go through it and do what I needed to do without ever focusing on what other people were doing to me.
And how do you see that experience now, that those 4 years and the times after? Do you feel like that's a positive thing that happened in your life, or a negative thing, or something in between, bittersweet?
Well, you know, I talked about that treadmill and wanting to be prepared for whatever. It did that. There has been nothing in my life since then that was anywhere near as difficult as that. And it has, you know, so I'm not afraid to do things. I don't necessarily feel like I'm on my own. I can call one of my big brothers or one of my sisters and say, have you done this before? Even if I don't know them that well. For me, it was positive because it helped me to grow exponentially faster than what I would have before. It helped me to understand people and their motivations. It helped me to love people even when they're not being loving. It helped me to not live in the world that people try to paint for me, but to understand the world as it is and the value and importance of every individual in that world, and that they deserve my attention.
So tell people a little bit about what you've done since. Well, I guess, first of all, you, as the commissioned officer coming out of the academy, mm-hmm. you had a service commitment, right? Mm-hmm. And what did you do during that time?
You know, that my detailer, the individual I talked about earlier who sends us to our different jobs, he called me his little change agent. So if it wasn't bad enough to have to be constantly under stress at the academy, I was put in jobs that were catastrophes. So it was...
So you're like a troubleshooter kind of person?
So we have a 5-year commitment. I spent probably most of the first year in school getting ready for my specialty, either between leave and then school, probably about 7 or 8 months. And after that, I had 3 different duty stations in the remaining 4 years, all going to deal with issues that may have been severe personnel issues, severe financial or procurement issues, or on a ship supporting, you know, our nuclear submarines.
And I'm assuming that in all those jobs, you were also the first black woman that they saw in any of those spots, right? Because you were the first one kind of out the door.
I probably was, yeah. Well, definitely from the Naval Academy, but maybe just in general, I probably was, if not the first woman. In those days, I might have been the first woman in those jobs.
And did you find any difficulties because of that in those kind of things after you got out?
Well, it would have been a piece of cake. But if that was their reason for not liking me, I didn't. See, I don't go there first. I really don't pay much attention to that. I come in to do a job. I'll get to know you. You'll get to know me. You know, one of the jobs, I'll never forget, I had a job for one of the corporations I worked for, and I was a production leader, and it was in an area they never had a minority or a woman in that, and it was all white, middle-aged men that I was leading. And we had a talk. I brought in all my shifts and sat in a circle and had them sit around me in a rolling chair and just said, talk. And some of them said, you know, with tears in their eyes, I can't work for you. I can't face my friends. How do I tell my friends I work for a black woman? And then but that's okay, because I needed to know what they were feeling. And they were saying, black women don't do anything but clean my house and take care of my children. So how did they go, this can't happen? And I looked at them and I said, well, excuse me, I'm a Southern woman. So I said, honey, If I can take care of the most important thing you have in your life and you walk out that door and feel comfortable leaving me there with it, let me allow you to show you what I can do for you here. Just give me a chance. We were the number one producing plant in that system before it was over. Those were my boys. So, you know, but they had to know that they could say what they need to say. Now, I still watched them. We had big screws that move product. And every once in a while, they get made up. They get stopped up, right? And they send some of the smaller people down there to break it up. And they call me and say, Janie, the screw's made up. You want to climb down here and get it? And I said, no, I'm not going to be your accident today. You're not turning that screw So they would laugh throughout. You could hear it throughout the towers, just them laughing.
Mm-hmm. And so you've done sort of business management, consulting, mm-hmm. all those sorts of things, right? Mm-hmm. What particular things out of the academy do you feel like have translated especially well to those jobs? Yeah.
I don't think there's anything that happened in the academy that didn't translate into every aspect of my life. Like I said, some of the things that I've mentioned beyond the academic part in terms of understanding that everything we do is a process. And if you can boil it down and understand the process, you can make it better, not only from a fiscal perspective, but for also for people. And I've used that a lot in my business experience. But in terms of understanding people and realizing that, you know, corporations are people. And unless you are working with the people part of that and making it, enabling them to do the best job that they can do, you're only going to be marginally successful.
You said you go back to the academy quite a bit mm-hmm. to talk and meet people. What do you feel like the atmosphere is like for women and minorities there now?
It's definitely better. We still have work to do, just like the rest of the country. But they're not having to fight their way into the place, so that's good. But we still, you know, we still have challenges, and a lot of them because we're not talking honestly. When people say things, because that's the only way they know how to say it, we get offended and start calling them names. We don't stop and try to understand what they're really trying to communicate and get past how I heard had somebody tell me that every time, like, hear somebody talk like this, they get scared. How do you get back? People can't even speak in their own accent without you feeling they threaten you. So, you know, we've got to get past all of that if we're going to make any progress. And that still needs to happen at the academy, just like it does in the rest of the country.
I want to circle all the way back to the beginning, mm-hmm. that little moment with your mom and your mm-hmm. your sister. I had to do a double take when I read this the first time. Mm-hmm. Your sister, your sickly little sister, mm-hmm. ended up following you to the Naval Academy.
She did.
Like a year behind you, right?
Yes, she was.
First of all, why the heck did she go to the Naval Academy after what? Did you tell her what you went through?
I didn't tell her in detail. My parents would probably come pick me up. But I told her don't, because she had Ivy League scholarships too. So I said, you know, and I knew she was not going to do what she was supposed to do. So she was going to keep me really busy trying to keep her out of trouble. So she, I tried to talk her out of it, but she came anyway. And she did extremely well.
And did you guys sort of look out for each other while you were there?
No. Uh-huh. She was. I was a fencer when I first got there until I got injured. And so she was a fencer, too. So she was busy with that all the time. Two different classes. So the classes pretty much so did stuff together. I was a class of 80. She was class of 81. I rarely ever saw her. And it was better for her, too, because there was a strong dislike for the class of 80. And it was almost better that people didn't know and didn't associate us for her, that I didn't want to bring that down on her too.
I know this is maybe a dumb question, but
no dumb question.
I don't know how to ask it other way. If your mom had not told you to get off her lap, and she had just held you there a little while longer, would everything that happened afterward have been different?
No, you know why? Because that was just, it was not my mom being mean. It was a lesson God had for me to learn. So if she hadn't taught it to me, he'd have taught it to me some other way.
Janie Mines is clearly a person of deep faith. And as you heard, she gives the credit to God for helping her navigate the rough water she faced at the Naval Academy. But I'm reminded of that old saying that God helps those who help themselves. Not many of us would have been tough enough to withstand all that she withstood in her 4 years in Annapolis. She defeated so many opponents, all those men who were racist or sexist or simply afraid to change. She outlasted them all. The irony is, of course, that all along, she had exactly the kind of character the Academy is supposed to be looking for. Southbound is a production of WFAE in Charlotte. Our producer is Nick Della Canal. Our web managers are Jessa O'Connor and Zuri Berry. Our audience engagement producer is Joni Deutsch. And our main theme music comes from Josh Turner. You can listen to this and every episode of Southbound on the NPR One app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever else you listen to podcasts. You can also find Southbound on WFAE.org, where each episode has show notes with more information on that week's guests. See y'all next time. Thanks for listening.
Support for Southbound comes from WFAE members and Southeast Radiation Oncology Group, offering non-invasive alternatives to surgery and treatments in radiation oncology. Details at treatcancer.com. Additional support is provided by the Knight Foundation.